Welcome to Voting Matters, a series of conversations about the voting process from WUKY and the League of Women Voters. Now, here's your co-hosts, Liza Holland, president of the Lexington chapter of LWV, and WUKY's Alan Lytle.
Welcome once again, Liza.
Well, thank you so much for having me again, Alan.
So, what's going on with the league, especially we're getting into October now?
Well, it has been a really crazy time. We've been doing a lot of tabling and encouraging people to register to vote, to double check their registrations and all that kind of a thing, doing candidate forums in partnership with Civic Lex, and also we do virtual forums, getting them up and on board. So it's been really busy in September up until October the 7th, which is your last day to register or change. Then we go into make a plan to vote mode. And so we're going to be focusing on encouraging people to make a plan. And we're going to try canvassing for the very first time in Lexington. So we may be knocking on your door. Just really more relationship building than anything else, but encouraging people to use that wonderful civic right on getting out to vote.
And speaking of voting, well, our guest today is going to give you everything to know about your vote, why it matters, and what happens to it once it's cast. And that would be our own Kentucky Secretary of State, Michael Adams, who joins us right now.
Hey there. How are you all?
Just great. Thank you.
Can you kind of describe how busy you've been here in the last several weeks?
It is nonstop. It is easily 6 and sometimes 7 days a week. The lead up to Election Day, folks think that we work 2 days a year, primary day and general election day. It really is a year-long effort, working with the county clerks to design their voting plans for their localities, working during the legislative session to get them adequate funding, a lot of travel around the state. As I mentioned just a moment ago, I was down in Wayne County, way, way, way out there on the Tennessee border last night, speaking about the election, encouraging people to vote early. A lot of media interviews. I have several of those almost every single day. So it is a labor of love. There's always more work to do.
Yeah, and what do people need to be aware of or in terms of this coming election that might be a little bit different?
So I think the best news I have is that there should be very little, if any, change to the voter experience from the last few elections that we've had. Obviously, my first election in 2020, I implemented very significant changes as were necessary to ensure that we could vote safely and securely in the pandemic, prior to a vaccine being available. Fortunately, some of the things that I implemented were made permanent by the legislature, like early voting and absentee ballot access being improved, tracking being available also for those. We make a lot of changes on the back end to ensure a smooth process, but voters won't see anything really different this election, except that in a presidential general election, the turnout really spikes. We typically have about 15% turnout in a primary. We have about 40% turnout in a non-presidential general election. And in a presidential general election, it's 55 to 60. And what that means is you have a lot of low propensity voters who take 4.5 years off, and then they suddenly pay attention to politics, and then they show up, and they don't know what's changed. Their precinct may have changed. Their people they can vote for may therefore have changed. They may not be used to the voting days or the locations. And so if I have any one thing I'd like to encourage people to do today, it's visit govote.ky.gov. It is the Swiss Army knife of Kentucky elections. You can register to vote there. You can update your registration. You can check your information. You can volunteer to be a poll worker. You can request an absentee ballot. You can find out the dates and the times that voting is available for you every day that we have voting, every location that's available. It's all right there. It's the best thing we have. Plus, your sample ballot. We had lines in 2022 because we had constitutional amendments. People saw those for the first time. They tried to understand them. They're very long and legalistic. I want to encourage people to look at your sample ballot at our website, govote.ky.gov, so that you're informed before you vote.
That is excellent, excellent advice. I know we are coming right up on that October 7th deadline to register to vote. I wonder if you could speak to our college students. What options do they have if they're coming to school here in Kentucky, but maybe they live out of state or their location is in another part of the state?
The first thing that they should do is confirm where they're registered. People forget. Especially people that move among different states or among different counties. I grew up in Paducah. I registered to vote in Paducah, and then I went to college in Louisville. And I chose to stay a resident of McCracken County and vote there, but some people change their registration to where they're living when they go to college. And it's totally your choice. It's the voter's prerogative to decide where you vote. If you're from another state and you want to vote in Wisconsin or Maine or wherever, that's your right as you wish. If you want to vote in the other state, then you're going to want to check with their Secretary of State and see what those laws are for getting your ballot in. If you're voting here, then I would just encourage you to check your information at our website and make sure that it's right. If you are going to be out of your county during all the in-person voting days, which are Election Day, the 5th of November, plus No Excuse Early Voting Days, October 31st through November 2nd, if you're going to be away at college out of your county on those days, then you have the right to vote by absentee ballot, and you can request that at our website, govote.ky.gov.
I have a question about election security. So what measures are currently in place to ensure the security and integrity of Kentucky's elections, especially concerning potential cybersecurity threats?
We have literally volumes of law addressed to your question, but I'll try to summarize as best I can. We take every aspect of this very, very seriously. And I don't just mean the security of the ballot and the integrity of the process. I mean the physical, personal security of my staff, of our poll workers. Unfortunately, those are things that we used to be able to take for granted, and now we just can't. In terms of personal security for voters and for our poll workers, number one, we got a law passed to strengthen legal protections for all of our election community, whether it's people like me at the top or people at the ground level who are actually sending in voters and counting ballots. We have, by law, the sheriff of every county is on the county board of elections. And so that means that the sheriff's office is highly tuned in and part of deciding where voting happens to make sure locations are secure. So, for example, we've tried to get rid of locations, old precinct locations that didn't have cell phone access, which is a lot of places in Kentucky, just because we want to be able to respond quickly if there's a 911 call. So we consider security as we choose the voting locations. In terms of the voting process itself, some states, unlike us, actually do utilize the internet as part of the election process. We do not. We use old-fashioned 1980s technology. We use calculators. We use optical scanners, like when I was in high school and I took a Scantron test. We use very old-fashioned technology that is hack-proof. You can't hack a calculator. You can't hack a paper ballot or a pen that you use to fill it out. You can't hack an optical scanner. These things don't have modems. They don't connect to the internet. And so our elections are secure from any sort of threats. One last point. This has been disclosed by U.S. intelligence, so I'm not saying anything that's classified. But other countries are trying to influence our elections. And we have countries that are rogue nations that are trying to tip it one way, and we have others that are trying to tip it the other way. But I think it's very telling that the way they're trying to do that is not by trying to break in to the voting itself. They can't. The way they're trying to do that is to foment disputatious confrontations among our citizens and divide the public. They're trying to turn us against each other as Americans and make us distrust each other and hate each other. And that's how they're trying to influence our elections, by utilizing us as the guinea pigs versus trying to influence the voting itself.
Absolutely. And how are you and your office addressing the spread of information and disinformation about elections? Are there any suggestions that you have as far as individuals looking at what's popping up on their social media?
I would strongly encourage people to get their information from legitimate sources. That is county clerks in Kentucky. They are elected election officials too, locally. They can tell you the truth and they can help you separate fact from fiction. Obviously, my office does a lot on this front as well. We do a lot of news interviews, a lot of social media. I'm going to be very blunt, though. There are some people in our state and our country that will not believe anything that the government says. They are so jaded about the government. So those people won't listen to me. But sometimes they'll listen to the county clerk, and sometimes they'll listen to the poll worker, because the poll workers are people they know personally, and it's their neighbors. And so we've really tried to lean into our people on the ground level. I can't get everywhere, and there are people that wouldn't trust me if I did. But we try to really put our county clerks forward and our poll workers forward as examples of just regular folks in our communities who are part of this process, because there's a likelier possibility of trust if it's someone local than if it's someone just in the state capital.
Yeah. Now, you have mentioned poll workers, and that leads us to the next question. You're always looking for poll workers, and I've noticed that you have a partnership with the breweries and wineries. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that wasn't to get free beer and wine. I know how it looks, but we've actually had a great partnership with them for years, and we actually have added the Restaurant Association. We have restaurants joining in as well. In 2020, we launched a program called SOS from Your SOS. Ohio had the idea of using breweries and wineries to promote voter registration, and we do that too, but we also use the QR code that they put on wine bottles and beer bottles and beer cans and on table tents and restaurants. We use a QR code that directs people to be a poll worker, to sign up at our portal at govvote.ky.gov and become a poll worker. And I'll be limited in how I describe this. We've not seen a sea of thousands and thousands of people, but we have had several hundred, and we're closing in on 1,000. And that makes a big difference when you're trying to open thousands of voting locations in our state. Increasingly, we see a decline in volunteering in America and in Kentucky. And a lot of the seniors that have worked the polls since I started voting 30 years ago, they're aging out. And my generation, Gen X, is not very good about volunteering. And my daughter's generation, Generation Z, is even worse. We've got to inculcate a sense of, you know, an ethos of volunteering in America, of civil society. And part of that is having poll workers. And so we're trying to reach out to non-traditional people, people who enjoy a nice dinner out or a nice wine. We need those people working the polls too.
Absolutely. And, you know, your generational differences comment is it's really powerful in our politics today. What do you think about youth engagement, and how can schools and other local organizations better engage young people in the civic process?
Well, I'd like to think that our youth are optimistic and they're dreamy-eyed and they'll want to participate. And we've had some success with that. The YMCA Youth Association has been a great partner with us. For years, they had a program where they go into high schools and register everyone who's old enough to vote. But now, working with us, they also asked them to volunteer to be poll workers. But I'll be candid. Kids are different today than when my generation were kids. And I think they have just as much desire to save the world and to do good. But I think they have a different view of how that's done, and they're less likely to do something like this. They're not joiners to the degree that older generations were. They're very distrustful of institutions, including the government. If you may have seen, there was a front page story in the Washington Post 3 weeks ago about how the Army's having trouble recruiting because they have trouble finding young people who want to serve the country. Young people don't always trust the government. So that's a big challenge for us. I think what would help is if we brought back civics education to our classrooms. Only 15% of our school districts in Kentucky currently offer a civic education course. If you go back to the history of public education in Kentucky, the primary reason it was created and put in the Constitution was to ensure that we could train citizens for self-government. And I think this needs to be part of that, is instilling a sense of community and young people where they don't just take democracy for granted.
Boy, that's a very powerful statement right there, and I completely agree with you. But in some respects, because education has gotten to where it is right now, we as a society kind of need to take collective responsibility and stop finger pointing and really try to be thinking about this as we interact with our younger people and encourage them and explain why it is that you think it's important to vote or participate in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. My daughter voted for the first time this year. She voted in May in the primary. And that's largely because her dad, dad's Secretary of State, made her register and took her to the polls. But when I was a kid, my parents took me to the polls. It was really important that they took me and that I saw that. And then I was a poll worker when I was a teenager, and it changed my life. And I really hope that other people get that experience.
Now, given the current political climate, are you seeing a reluctance in people volunteering to become poll workers? Because, well, I just don't want to deal with that kind of hassle.
Well, I have some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that we have seen a real challenge in getting poll workers. But the good news is that's not the reason why. It could be the reason why in Georgia or Arizona, because you've had some pretty volatile situations there where poll workers have been falsely accused of things. That's not happened in Kentucky, and we've seen no tie between those instances in other states and the mentality here. People aren't scared. They're not worried. There's other factors. One is just the decline in a sense of community and participation. The other is geographical polarization. So we require by law to have a mix of Democrats and Republicans at every precinct, which is appropriate. But our blue counties are getting more blue and our red counties are getting more red. And so it's harder to find Democrats in, say, Adair County or Allen County. It's harder to find Republicans in Jefferson or Fayette County. And that's actually kind of hurting it, too. It's hard to find enough people of one party to balance out the other party. And we used to be a state that had Democratic and Republican areas, but they were all fairly even. And you had a lot of swing counties, and that's just not the case anymore. So that's a twist that makes it a little bit harder too.
Well, and you know, I think that a lot of people don't realize that at the polls you have that kind of party parity where you have both a Republican and a Democrat to be able to, you know, kind of encourage the trust in the process. But boy, that is just such a long-term type of a challenge there. What do you suggest as far as maybe looking into a short-term fix, as far as looking into encouraging our Gen X types of folks to be able to get out there? And maybe they too can be putting that on their mind for their kids longer term.
We have a lot of work to do across the board, and I think that we can improve participation at the youngest level by getting into the classroom and talking about the American way of life and our system of government and the duties of citizens and so forth. For people who are out of school, it's more of a challenge, and so we've tried to work with civic organizations. Just last night, I was in Monticello, Kentucky, as a guest of the local Chamber of Commerce. They had a candidate forum, all the candidates for various offices, partisan and nonpartisan. That's really important. And I told them, what you're doing, this is really important. There aren't many civic spaces anymore. I know LWV does this, but there aren't many others that have candidate forums and just let people be heard and feel like they are informed about for whom they're voting. I can put a sample ballot out, but it just says who's running. It doesn't tell you anything about them. I can't get into that kind of stuff. One of the big challenges today is that people increasingly aren't paying for news. So they're not getting information that at least attempts to be objective. There are more fake news sites than there are legitimate news sites now. That's a quantified actual thing. And to the extent people get news, they're getting it really from entertainment channels that are focused on Washington. And so my office did a Civic Health Index survey recently, and we found people are likelier to know who a member of Congress is from another state than they are to know their own mayor or their own county officials or state legislator. And that's totally backwards. So I think the more that we can stress localism, that's good for a couple of reasons. Number one, those people actually have a lot more to do with your quality of life than who's in Congress. But number two, when people are more focused on the local, they see that their differences are not that significant. It's not you going to war with someone from another cultural viewpoint 3,000 miles away. It's your neighbors and your friends and people you see when you walk your dog. And that takes some of the toxicity out of politics.
I have a couple of questions of kind of a nuts and bolts perspective going back to elections. Voter ID requirements, especially in Kentucky.
So we do require voters to prove their identity. There are various ways that can be done. The default is to provide a photo ID that is a federal, state, or local government issued ID. My daughter, when she voted in May, used her student ID. She goes to a public school, and that counts. It's a government agency. They issue photo ID, so that's what she used. I've worked to permit colleges to permit college IDs to be utilized, trade school IDs. The reason I point that out is it's in our law. There was an attempt to take that out of our law and not let college students use their IDs. We fortunately were able to defeat that. But 99%, though, of Kentucky voters use their driver's license. That typically is the most convenient thing to do. But there are various other IDs that we'll accept. We do have bypasses for people who do not have and cannot get a photo ID. One is if the poll worker knows you, then the poll worker can fill out an oath of voter form, and that's sufficient. We also have a reasonable impediment law that says that if you can't get an ID, we have various boxes on the form that you can check for why you can't, and then you can vote with a non-photo ID. So, this rarely happens, but if you literally don't have an ID and for whatever reason can't sign the oath about why, you can still vote a provisional ballot. That's federal law. The provisional ballot is only for use in the federal election, so all the state local stuff isn't on there. It's just the president and the Congress. And then you're entitled to a hearing before your county board of elections to get your ballot counted to be able to verify your identity. But we might have a few hundred of those cast out of millions of votes, so they're pretty rare.
The other question I had, if a person is a citizen of the United States, but English is not their primary language or their first language, what provisions are there for language differences?
Well, there is a federal law that basically there's a formula. And if a particular jurisdiction, let's say Jefferson County, if Jefferson County has a particular proportion of individuals who don't speak English as a first language, then by federal law, then Jefferson County would have to produce ballots in other languages, guidance in other languages, and so forth. But Kentucky's population is not sufficiently diverse that any of our counties fall under this formula. So all of our ballots, all of our guidance that is issued by government entities is all in English.
Are voters able to go ahead and bring a translator with them if they don't feel confident in their particularly written English?
It is permissible to bring a translator, but you cannot have aid in voting. If you're blind and so forth, then there are some exceptions. But it's a general matter for pretty good reason. We don't want multiple people at one booth filling out a ballot because of concerns about vote buying and so forth. So someone can help translate, but ultimately it's going to be the voter himself or herself filling out the ballot.
Okay, so you could see this conversation taking place and they're talking back and forth, but then only the voter enters the voting booth and then they pretty much have to remember, recall, or, duplicate what they intended to do when they were talking with the interpreter.
Correct.
Okay. That's always been a question that I wanted to ask. And you're right. I mean, we don't have a lot of people that, citizens that don't speak English primarily, but we do have some. Now, in the time that we have left, Mr. Secretary, you have on your website some truths versus some myths, and I thought we should maybe hit a few of those. About voting. Number one.
Truth: a straight ticket vote only applies to partisan candidates on your ballot.
Yeah, I like to tell folks, if you're a straight ticket voter, and a lot of our voters are one way or the other, that's your right, but you're not done voting yet, because we have a lot of elections that aren't partisan elections. We have nonpartisan elections in many of our cities for city council, for mayor. We have nonpartisan elections for school board. We have judges on the ballot in some places this year. We have two constitutional amendments. Actually, most of the votes on my ballot, I pulled mine recently. Most of my choices are not partisan races. They're nonpartisan races. So that means I have to go do my homework on who these people are and what these amendments are about, right? But voting straight ticket is not going to cover those. So I would encourage people, if you want to vote straight ticket, that's your right. But make sure that you're prepared for the other things on your ballot. And again, go to our website, govote.ky.gov, and look at your sample ballot first.
And that obviously doesn't pertain to the amendments, the Constitutional Amendment 1 and 2.
Yeah, and I said this already, but I want to reiterate it. I want to avoid lines, because lines means not just inconvenience, it means people are disenfranchised. The last time I voted before I was in office, I waited for 3+ hours to vote for president. It was a long line, and I'm stubborn enough to stand there for 3 hours, but a lot of folks aren't. And I saw a lot of people turn around and walk off and shake their heads and not vote. So I want to prevent that. I want everyone to be counted. The best way to ensure that is that we don't have people clogging the voting booths, taking their sweet time reading and even Googling people on the ballot or these amendments. These amendments are written in legalese. That's not my decision. The state Supreme Court, right before I took office, issued a ruling that said the Secretary of State can't just summarize in plain English for voters what these things would do. We have to lay them out word for word, and so we're going to follow the order of the court. But unfortunately, that means the ballot's pretty long, and there's a lot of legalistic language that regular people don't really understand. I would encourage people to go read the language, but then also talk to your family, your friends, coworkers, about what these things really mean and what impacts they would have.
That makes a tremendous amount of sense, and that's good advice. And I'm kind of disappointed in our that court ruling. The next one is that Kentucky's elections are more accessible to voters than ever before. And I just want to personally give you a shout out, because you have been a real leader in this area. And Kentucky,
thank you.
Well, I mean, compared to other states nationally, Kentucky has really done more cooperatively to be able to give access. And I'd love for you to kind of give your thoughts on why you think it's important.
Well, I think there's a false dichotomy out there that if you make voting easier, you're going to have fraud. That's just totally wrong. We have secure elections, and we quadrupled the number of days people could go vote. And the elections are just as secure as they were. And there's really no relationship between having elections that are fair and honest and having ones that are open and accessible to voters. There's no trade-off whatsoever. Most decisions in government are a trade-off. It's, well, you get this, but then you get that. That's just not true here. And we've proved that to the rest of the country. I do wish, I'm a Republican, and I do wish that other Republicans in other states would pay more attention to how we've done elections here, because we haven't been partisan. We've opened our polls. We haven't taken away voting days from people. And you know what? Republicans do just fine mm-hmm. if you let people vote. So there should be no partisan motives in this stuff. Just let people vote and then let them sort it out.
Yeah. In Georgia, they just passed a law, correct, about hand counting of ballots. Kentucky doesn't do that. And what's your reaction to what they've done in Georgia?
So that was a vote by the state election board. It's not in the law. But we do have an audit process where it's randomized. We don't count every vote by hand. And we also don't cherry pick and try to potentially overturn particular elections that we don't like. That's how some other states have done it. But what we do is we have the double win of a quick count, but also a paper trail. We do have paper ballots now. That's something that I've done in 4 years, because I trust paper, and I think most voters do. But if you hand count paper, you're going to have mistakes. You're also going to have potential corruption. In 1940, Kentuckians voted to change our state constitution to move away from hand count to machine count. That didn't just happen. It happened because there was fraud in the vote counting. And if you have neutral optical scanners scanning people's choices versus people that are recruited by the parties judging their choices, you're going to have less opportunity for corruption and illegality and stolen elections. And so I think it's ironic that people in the name of integrity are moving to something that was done almost 100 years ago that has been disregarded and debunked for leading to so much corruption.
One other question dealing with elections themselves. What happens to the ballot once it is cast and what they call the chain of custody?
So we have universalized this, where now every ballot in Kentucky is cast on a piece of paper. It may be filled out by hand. That's what the vast majority of our voters do. We have some voters who, because of whatever disability, prefer or have to vote on what's basically a big printer. It's not a voting machine, but they'll pick their choices on a computer screen and hit print and then print out a ballot that looks just like one that's been filled out by hand. But regardless, those all go into the optical scanner, and then they fall into a little bin under the optical scanner, and they're preserved. And we have a law that requires in every part of the state, in every county, one precinct and one race to be hand recounted as a verification that the counter was working correctly. But we don't count every single one by hand. It would be millions of ballots. It would take days or maybe weeks to count them all, and then there'd be mistakes. So I think we have the right approach here. We get the speed of a quick count. When you have a delay in the count, you tend to have more conspiracy theories about, oh, well, you know, there was a big bump against my candidate when Thursday's votes were counted, right? Like there must have been something going on. You have more confidence in the election when the votes are counted very, very quickly. So we get the speed of that quick count, but we also have the security of a paper trail. In 2018, there was a tie in a state house race in Owensboro, and the court there ordered a recount, and the county clerk said, well, I can't, Your Honor, there's no ballots. Everybody was voting on a computer. There weren't ballots to count, and we'll never really know what exactly happened. So that was part of why I tried to get to paper ballots. But now we can actually go back by hand if we must and have a separate count. And I'd add this too. Back in 2022, I got sued several times by people who ran in Republican primaries. They lost by large margins. They alleged that the corrupt uniparty was changing votes and all this stuff. And so we said, all right, let's do it. Let's recount them. Every single count came back the exact same all over the state. And that really kind of pushed back on this misinformation. I think that's why you see less of it in our state today.
Well, that's really powerful. And, you know, even if there are any types of questions, you've got all kinds of security measures in place. Can you tell us a little bit about the Election Assistance Commission and the State Board of Elections and what role they would play?
So the Election Assistance Commission was established by Congress after the 2000 presidential election, specifically in Florida. And so their primary role is to allocate funding, federal funding, to states. And they have given us, I've lost count, but I want to say collectively over 5 years, about $15 million to maintain and also upgrade our systems to make them more secure. Our legislature has done that as well. Their other role is just to share information and to help promote public awareness of how secure the elections are. And we have a state board of elections. It's four Democrats, four Republicans, and they are a separate level of review. And I think some folks think that I count all the votes. I actually don't. And that's good, because no one person should do that. We have multiple levels. So on election night, at every precinct, the even mix of Democrats and Republicans all have to certify the accuracy of the count on all the scanners that they have had run that day. And then they provide that to their county board of elections, which is by law also a mix of Democrats and Republicans. And then those county boards report to me. And then we check those results. And then we give them to the state board of elections, which is Democrats and Republicans. And all those levels all have to agree. And it's several Democrats and several Republicans at about four different levels. But guess what? We actually end up agreeing because it's not political. We're just counting numbers. And so I think having a bipartisan approach to this is good. We've done that legislatively. We've worked with the governor and legislators of both parties. And people see that. And I think between knowing that there's D's and R's at the polls and there's D's and R's working together on the policy, that just reinforces public confidence in the process.
Question for you. Kentucky is widely considered in looking at this presidential race, not a battleground state. Talk about what might be going on in the Secretary of State's offices in those so-called battleground states.
I think they're doing a lot of the same stuff that we're doing. And I talk to my colleagues of both parties really frequently, at least once a week. We just check in with each other on things that we're facing. But we all kind of have the same process. We all have to design or at least work with localities on designing what the voting is going to look like, what locations, what hours, ensuring it's not just accessible, but also fair. You want to be fair to urban voters. You want to be fair to rural voters. And fortunately, we've just done this enough times. We've got a pretty good sense of how to do that. That's a big part of it. Another big part of it is just public messaging. It's nonstop. It's all day, every day. And sometimes it's getting your message out. And then a lot of times it's just, unfortunately, having to react to some false message that's out there and then put people's mind at ease. I hate to say it, but some of it's personal safety training. We have to do a lot of tabletop exercises for, you know, what do we do if people come and firebomb our offices or things like that? What do you do if there's an active shooter at the Secretary of State's office? Unfortunately, that's part of our life now, too. A lot of it is just waiting for the phone to ring and not knowing what it's going to be and just preparing yourself. So I'd say one upside of the last 4 years, when I ran for this office in 2019, I had no idea what I was getting into. I thought I was doing stamp paperwork. And the county clerks, I think, had the same view back in 2018 when they all ran. And then we all lived through 2020 and 2022. And everyone that is in office now, in those positions, mine too, we all knew what we signed up for. And we're all ready for this psychologically, but also just in terms of better preparation, better thinking outside the box for what contingencies could happen. By law, both we and every county clerk's office has a contingency plan. And so I like to tell people, you know, the question is, what happens if the power goes out when we have the election? The answer is, we have the election. We've got plans for all those situations.
If somebody witnesses something on election day at their particular polling place, what can they do about it?
Well, the Attorney General, unlike me, has prosecutorial authority and investigative authority. I strongly encourage people to call 800-328-VOTE. If you see something, then you should say something. It could be an attempt to influence voting improperly. It could be electioneering too close to the polls. It could be something even more sinister than that. This hotline makes a difference, and I'll give you an example. We've only had one situation of people convicted of election fraud since I've been in office, and it came from a tip to this hotline. And I think this is an important point. It was a Republican primary. And I think people that think that Democrats are stealing elections from Republicans or vice versa, well, the only actual attempt at fraud that we've had was Republicans trying to steal an election from other Republicans in Monroe County. And this was a vote buying case. People were selling and buying votes. And they got caught thanks to a tip to the hotline, and they were apprehended. They were prosecuted successfully. They were sent to prison in some of their cases. Others were low level people that got probation, and justice ruled. And the guy that cheated didn't win the election. And so that's how it's supposed to work. You're you're going to have bad people do bad stuff. That's why you have laws. Fortunately, it's not happened at the level that would influence the outcome of any election that we've had the past 4 years. But I do want to encourage people, if you see something, tell us, because your tip could be the one that actually leads to us getting these folks.
So I guess maybe a final question here. There's a lot of talk out there about how elections can be swung, and a lot by those people who choose to not get up and go and vote. And so I know that we have that problem in some respects when the media is saying, oh, well, it's all said and done, right? So you don't really need to go out and vote because we already know who's going to win. But especially in some of these local elections, sometimes it can be 10, 15, 20 votes that could make the difference. And our leadership is really it expands well beyond just the top ticket, right? So what would your final advice be to people who are on the fence as to whether they're going to get out to the polls or not?
Well, I would say that there's only one race that is national on your ballot, and so therefore only one race where you may feel like your vote is superfluous, but there's a ton of other stuff on the ballot. There are constitutional amendments, which are the closest thing that we have in Kentucky to direct democracy, where literally any Kentuckian can decide what the Constitution is going to say or not say. We have school board races. We've certainly seen how important it is to have people of good caliber on our school boards with all the challenges that we have in education. And so, you know, these people, they don't raise a lot of money. They don't do advertising, really. The only way for you to even know about them is to go out on your own and do some research. But those people are on the ballot. You've got, in some cases, judges. You've got lots of offices that have a great deal of impact and arguably a lot more impact on your daily life than who the president is. So I would encourage people not just to vote, but to be informed when you do. The number one reason people tell me they don't vote is they feel intimidated by the ballot. There are so many offices they don't know anything about. Hey, I'm the chief election official. I got stuff on my ballot. I don't know what it is. There's like a land and soil conservation survey or something. I don't even know what that is. I got to go look it up. But that's intimidating. We, compared to other states, we elect a lot more of our offices compared to most other states. And there's some good in that. That means potentially more public accountability. But it also means that we have to be accountable as citizens and go learn our stuff before we vote.
Well, Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams, we want to thank you very much for your time. I know you're extremely busy, and you took the time to answer all of our questions, and we really appreciate that. And obviously, give us those dates again for early voting when the first ballots can be cast in Kentucky.
You can cast your ballot now if you're voting absentee. Our portal is open at govote.ky.gov, and so based on your physical location during the in-person voting days, if you're out of your county for any reason, or if you're based on your age or your health, you're not able to vote in person, you can choose to vote absentee. Go request your ballot at govote.ky.gov. The no excuse early voting days are Thursday, October 31st through Saturday, November 2nd. I think Saturday is a game changer for working people to have the flexibility to go vote and not have to worry about dealing with their boss about taking time away. So please go out and utilize that. And then Election Day, under the Constitution, the polls are open 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And you can find your locations, times, all of this good stuff at govote.ky.gov.
Well, thank you so much again. A huge hat tip to you and the huge army of people that are making these elections work that work with you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Wow, what a great conversation with Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams.
Boy, it was just kind of inspirational, wasn't it? Knowing how secure things are and encouraging people to get out to vote.
And we invite you to, in addition to planning to vote, to plan to listen to more episodes of Voting Matters as they will drop as we get closer and closer to Election Day.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Voting Matters, a podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the League of Women Voters. Subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, or download Voting Matters from the podcast page at wuky.org. We also have links from the organizations and guests mentioned in this program. See you next time for Voting Matters.